The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Our journey on today's Armchair Traveler begins in an isolated corner of Manitoba, one of the few places left in the world where humans are the outsiders on display for the wildlife to observe. That's according to writer Hillary Richard. Her article, Doing the Bump with the Belugas, appeared in the May 11th, 2020 issue of the New York Times. Beneath the waves, two smoldering coals for eyes watch me with an intense, unyielding stare. Pristine white bodies floated up elegantly from the depths, one after another, surrounding my kayak in the open water. Their ghostly pale faces with wide, jokeresque smiles pushed closer. A long, powerful sound burst up through the air, like a slowly deflating balloon, followed by silence and more expectant staring. I was having a one-sided conversation with a pod of curious beluga whales. The mouth of Churchill River in northern Manitoba, Canada, was calm and quiet on this chilly, overcast July day, but these bright white whales were not. Belugas, nicknamed the canaries of the sea, thanks to their song-like sounds, are social, playful, and highly communicative. They repeated their shrieks and tunes, floating around me in anticipatory silence. There was only one thing left to do, sing along. In response, raucous clicks and squeals drifted upward out of the dark water like someone tapping on a microphone for attention, broken by steady streams of blowhole bubbles. I got the distinct feeling that I was being discussed. Brace yourself, warned Noah Ransom, my wildlife guide, who had been singing his own songs to belugas in another kayak about 20 feet away. A beluga lined up beneath me in the 36-degree water. An adult female beluga can reach 13 feet in length, roughly the same size as my sea kayak, and weigh nearly 3,000 pounds. The kayak rose seamlessly and evenly as the beluga pushed me up about a foot out of the water, then lowered me back down. A storm of bubbles arrived off the side, then a flash of white appeared. An impish face stared up at me, looking for a reaction, like a puppy who had just nosed over a ball. I laughed in shock while Mr. Ransom clapped and cheered. The beluga dove back down, and raising and lowering the kayak a few more times, like the world's most gentle roller coaster. Although the belugas were massive and their potential for destruction seemed enormous, in these mere seconds their actions were light and playful. "We are kind of like their rubber duckies in the tub," Mr. Ransom said. "This is playtime." Each June, approximately 60,000 belugas migrate from Arctic waters down to Hudson Bay, which serves as a summer playground of sorts for the largest concentration of belugas worldwide. The whales give birth to these relatively warmer, sheltered waters where there is no real pressure on the fish population 9 months out of the year. In this part of North America, with its wide-open, often inhospitable landscape, keeping a distance from other humans comes naturally. As of May 8th, the isolated tundra town of Churchill had no cases of coronavirus. The province of Manitoba lists 283. The belugas interpret personal space much differently. Hudson Bay feeds into Churchill River, where around 1,000 belugas had taken up residence alongside our two sea kayaks last summer. They arrived in pods, bright, almost fluorescent white adults with happy clown faces, and the occasional gray baby tucked in between, trying to keep up with everyone else. As I paddled, belugas raced alongside the kayak. When I stopped, they nudged the paddles and rudders with a palpable curiosity. The sounds of gasping blowhole spouts mixed in with their normal chatter, which developed a kind of conversational rhythm as time went on. In an area of the world known for its majestic polar bears, the belugas have gone largely unnoticed. In autumn and early winter, tourists usually arrive in Churchill for a chance to see some of the roughly 1,000 polar bears living in that area. By then, the Hudson Bay is full of ice and the belugas are long gone. The whales' limited interaction with other species in Hudson Bay has allowed them to remain curious, innocent, and safe, possessing an almost childlike wonder. It was my own childlike wonder that brought me here. So many animals shape our childhood, though through stories and arts. They seem so real and present until one day the sing-alongs and the cartoons end. They are an integral part of our lives, but we aren't part of theirs. I am part of a generation that grew up singing about baby belugas so often that we seemed like long-lost friends. It felt like a foregone conclusion that one day we would cross paths somewhere in the deep blue sea. I arrived in Churchill knowing that nothing is guaranteed when it comes to wild animal encounters. I hoped to glimpse a beluga or two. Instead, out of the water, I entered a completely different world, one devoid of humans, where I was the strange creature on display. I had come to watch them, but really, these marvelous creatures were watching me. Even on a summer day on the water, Churchill was a quiet place, where the wind carried sounds for miles. The atmospheric buzz of all-terrain vehicles on coastal bear patrol hummed consistently in the background. Locals brought their children and dogs to splash in the tide and pick up pretty stones along the shoreline, taking advantage of the long northern sun. Polar bear warning signs went unheeded. The deafening hum of the vicious, biting fly seemed like more of an imminent threat. Off in the distance, past the fireweed and haphazard wildflowers, bright flashes of white caught the sunlight. That far out, with no accompanying sound, it was hard to tell whether they were cresting waves, swimming bears, or, much more likely, belugas. Wally Dowdrick, a tour guide, saw an opportunity to highlight the area's other less dangerous summer residents. Like the belugas, and many people who end up in Churchill full-time, Mr. Dowdrick only intended to stay for a season. 4 decades later, he runs Lazy Bear Lodge and the Associated Lazy Bear Tours, one of only 2 tour companies in town last year that offered water-based beluga tours and the only full-service one. Lazy Bear is cautiously optimistic about the 2020 summer season, but as the case these days, everything is subject to change. Every chance he gets, Mr. Dowdrick is out on the water, usually as the captain of the San Hearn, a tour boat named after one of his favorite historical figures who joined the British Royal Navy at age 13, then came to Hudson Bay at 18 to work as a trader. On tours, Mr. Dowdrick navigates along part of Ahern's old shipping route around Bottom Bay, the Prince of Wales Fort, and Eskimo Point, a favorite summer resting spot for polar bears. The day after my first kayaking beluga encounter, I joined Mr. Dowdrick on his tour boat, where he rattled off decades of observations and anecdotes about belugas. The whales like high-pitched sounds, especially women's and children's voices, possibly because those sounds hit the frequency belugas are used to. They notice bright colors. They have an uncanny instinct about people. They can sense chronic diseases and mobility issues, and they seem to have a greater curiosity for them, he said. They're very intelligent animals. They can clearly recognize the prop of each boat, said Mr. Dowdrick, who has often encountered pods of repeat visitors from his tour boat. Off to the side, a bright white whale shot up vertically, as if standing. The belugas occasionally spy-hop, pop straight up out of the water like a submarine scope, to get a better look at things, face to face. Underwater, belugas rely heavily on sound. They are some of the most vocal marine animals, using echolocation to bounce sound waves off surfaces and judge distances. Because of their natural habitat in dark, icy waters, belugas remain somewhat mysterious to scientists in many ways, but they are widely regarded as extremely intuitive and sensitive, with excellent communication skills. When the belugas are nearby, there are many comical sounds drift up above the water. Mr. Dowdrick likes to use a hydrophone, that's an underwater microphone, to listen in below the surface, which is nothing short of a cacophony. Beneath the waves, there's an overstimulated audio highway of chirps, clicks, shrieks, squeals, and static. It's crowded down there. There's lots of background chatter, like you would hear in a crowded room, he said. Most of their sounds are high-pitched, but they have a whole repertoire of lower sounds, too. The belugas are curious, playful, and unafraid, and as a result, Mr. Dowdrick has lost a number of hydrophones to the whales over the years. In general, the whales somehow recognize that their own strength and power in the water overshadow ours, and they are extremely gentle, but they are large, and accidents happen. They have occasionally tipped kayaks. They like to play. They'll lift you straight up and put you down, but if you stop paddling, they'll lose interest and go away, he said. And, of course, they like to chat. The Greater Churchill area is a place that, in theory, could be overrun with seasonal tour companies ready to cash in, but that was not the case when I visited. Part of it was because of its isolated geography. Last year, visitors could only travel to Churchill via an expensive charter flight or the notoriously unreliable two-day train, both originating from Winnipeg, 624 miles away. Another reason is its expense. Prices are high across the board in Churchill because of its inaccessibility, with most accommodations disproportionately expensive for their quality. There is no real market for the luxury traveler, and absolutely no patience for the selfie crowds. It's about the wildlife here, and anyone who wants more is missing the point. Churchill often gets overlooked, and in general, plenty of residents are fine with that. However, in 2018, the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans issued blanket nationwide restrictions on whale watching that required keeping a minimum distance of 100 meters or 328 feet at all times. This created a problem in Churchill because nobody told the belugas. In other places, most people see six whales on a tour, maybe 200, 300 yards out. Here it's 1,000 to 5,000 whales, and they love to interact, said Mr. Dowbrick, who pointed out that it's impossible to regulate naturally curious creatures that reach 3,500 pounds and 20 feet in length. The whales are so friendly here that we can't abide by those rules, he adds. We keep our distance, but they approach us. This comes in contrast to other areas, like the dwindling beluga population in Quebec's St. Lawrence River, which has heavy shipping traffic and large vessels. They behave differently in the St. Lawrence River than in their natural environment. They keep a distance from everyone because they use their bilbous foreheads to navigate and communicate, said Mr. Dowdrick, who noted that kayaks and inflatable zodiacs sit above the water and don't seem to interfere with their communication. Churchill's Beluga Whale Tour Operator Association, an advocacy group that establishes protections for the belugas and tourism codes of conduct among wildlife tour operators, petition the government on the issue. Mr. Dowdrick is president, alongside board members from Ventures North, Sea North Tours, and Churchill Wild, also associations. Before the 2018 restrictions, visitors had been able to snorkel in various places alongside whales, including the Churchill River. That was banned nationwide without exception, but after investigating the boat issue or boat distance issue, the federal government issued special Churchill-specific distance regulations. Lazy Bear came up with aquagliding, in which an inflatable boat tows a large foam mat that people can lie on and put their faces in the water. We found that when people are completely in the water, the whales back off around 5 to 10 feet. They especially don't seem to like scuba. I think it's the bubbles, Mr. Dowdrick said. In contrast, aquagliding keeps bodies out of the water, and the whales feel free to approach it at will. On a rainy July afternoon, I lay face down on a floating mat attached to a zodiac in Churchill River. I was completely covered in a dry suit and a snorkeling mask, ready to peek beneath the near-freezing waves. As soon as the engine turned off and we bobbed in the bay, flashes of white torpedoed toward me on each side, coming in closer and closer. I put my mask in the water and opened my eyes just in time to see a ghostly face. The beluga floated toward me, turning from side to side so that each wide-set eye could evaluate me. Nearly face to face, I could see for myself how expressive these creatures are. Unlike other whales, belugas have a flexible neck, making it possible for them to turn and look at you, even seemingly nod like humans. Their bulbous melon heads are also flexible, which allows them to make recognizable facial expressions. We locked eyes, and time seemed to stop. They exuded an innocence, wisdom, and patient acceptance I hadn't seen in my other wildlife encounters. Here we were, bobbing along in the same currents, very different beings, sharing the exact same moment in time. I got the sense, real or imagined, that we understood each other on the same level, or at least some level. The belugas would be gone in a few weeks. Each September, they head up north to the Arctic, where they live amid sea ice that protects them from predators, relying on their catalog of sing-song chirps, whistles, clicks, and tunes to communicate with each other and navigate their environment. This summer, they will bring their joyful noise back to the shelters of Churchill and Hudson Bay, whether the humans arrive or not. Hillary Richard is a freelance writer, and she is based in the New York City area, and she's working on a travel-inspired memoir. So, nice journey there, Well, wildlife watching is often one of the reasons people like to travel, and with that theme in mind, let's turn to writer Ramashaw Maroof's article, Seabirds Nest on Beach While Humans Barred from Area. Now, this was first published in the Florida Sun Sentinel and was reprinted in the July 31st, 2020 issue of the News and Observer. Dateline, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. When the humans left, the seabirds flocked home. A rare colony of least terns, and that's their name, least terns, a threatened federally protected seabird, landed on Deerfield Beach in March, when humans did not have access to the sand. This is the first southeast Florida nesting colony in decades and will probably be the last for years to come. The least tern form colonies on empty beaches, which in populated Broward County is a rare find. We have pushed them off, said Ann Wiley, who since late April has been guarding the colony. We have crowded them out, and as soon as we backed off, they returned. Wiley, a volunteer with the Florida Shorebird Alliance, became the lead organizer to protect the colony after it was discovered by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Even from the sidewalk during lockdown, Wiley said she felt she was watching them in their natural habitat at the kind of beaches you'd find on the secluded islands off the west coast of Florida. The least tern population has decreased by 88% over the past 40 years. That is due to the commercialization of beaches, much like Deerfield, where the dune vegetation used for a shade has been ripped out. Least terns are fishermen, and this colony was probably attracted to the bait fish off Deerfield Beach's pier. They're also the smallest of their kind. At any one time, about 50 birds are nesting. Wiley believes the colony will stay in Deerfield until late July or early August before all the birds have migrated to South America. For almost 2 months, the birds had the beach to themselves. When the beaches reopened in late May and the normal crowds returned, Wiley formed a team of volunteers to patrol the colony every day from 6 a.m. to midnight. Wiley is there herself almost every day. The lifeguards know her as the Bird Lady. Wiley marked off the colony with pink flagging tape and placed wooden pallets to protect the terns from the sun. There are more than 20 volunteers, many of them members of the local Audubon societies. Nancy Freeman travels all the way from Jupiter, Florida. Freeman points out a flock of them returning from the shore to feed their young, looking like small paper airplanes in the sky. "I've never seen them like this," Freeman said, "to be able to watch their behavior and how they interact." Freeman's shift lasts 2.5 hours. She looks for suspicious footprints that could have stepped outside inside the colony, or for any volleyballs being thrown around. One wrong serve could crush an egg. Visitors ask her why such a large portion of the beach is blocked off by pink tape. Wiley said the majority of beachgoers are respectful of the colony and is a major reason why it has survived even after the beaches opened up. There was a fear that when the humans returned, the adults would abandon their chicks. When they were flying over Deerfield, they must have felt the vibes of the beach, Wiley said. On July 7th, the least tern became the official city bird of Deerfield Beach. Though they will probably never return, City Commissioner Michael Huddock sees the birds as a way to tie everything together. COVID-19, the benefits of isolation, and the impact humans have on the environment. Well, what's a travel lover to do with so many venues closed or restricted because of the coronavirus pandemic? Well, a good travel book might be helpful. Summer Reads for Quarantine Travelers was written by Seth Combs for the San Diego Union-Tribune and reprinted in the June 28, 2020 issue of the News and Observer. And here's Seth's recommendations. With summer arriving, many of us still hunkered down at home. The concept of a seasonal vacation seems like a pipe dream. Many of us will take solace in books, perhaps catching up on travel classics such as Travels with Charlie, On the Road, or, if we're feeling brave, The Road and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Still, there are plenty of recent books and new classics that are perfect for travel-deprived readers with no vacation blues. It's often said that the best books can transport us, and that's just what the selections below will do. And here are what his recommendations include. Under the fiction category, Lost Children Archive, Valeria Luiselli. For those craving a road trip around the Southeast, Luiselli's recent novel is based on a cross-country excursion she took on her own with her own family in 2014. Starting in New York City and ending in the Arizona desert, Luiselli deftly weaves in present-day issues with the narrator helping her own children understand the region's violent past and current struggles with issues such as immigration. And this book, by the way, is 400 pages and published by Alfred Knopf. Then we have Flights by Olga Tarkasuk. Originally published in Tarkasuk's native Poland in 2007, this engrossing fragmentary collection of vignettes was recently translated and went on to win the Man Booker Prize. Although it was marketed as a novel, it's more a collection of stories and observations that center on the concept of constant motion, from reflections on airports to a multi-chapter story about a tourist searching for his missing children. This one's 416 pages and published by Riverhead Books. Then we have Death is Hard Work by Khalid Khalafa. While a trip to Syria was surely not in readers' current travel plans, Damascus-based writer Khalifa has penned a beautiful and heartbreaking story of three siblings on a cross-country road trip in order to bury their revolutionary father. The novel's real strength is Khalifa's ability to convey to readers a sense of just how much natural beauty the country has lost to civil war. This is just 192 pages, and it is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Then we have, in the final listing of the fiction, The Wangs Versus the World by Jade Jiang. Now, Jiang's hilarious 2016 novel feels particularly prescient in these times, considering this it's set, rather, in the 2008 financial crisis, and centers on a first-generation immigrant family traveling together across the country after losing their fortune. Told from the varying perspectives of each family member, the novel is already being adapted into a TV series. If you'd like to read it, it's 384 pages and published by Mariner Books. Now to the nonfiction listings. We have the Best American Travel Writing Series by various contributors, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt's annual collections, compiled the best articles published over the last year. And with a rotating cast of guest editors, past guests include such big names as Susan Orlean, Jamaica Kincaid, and Ian Fraser. This year's collection also includes an article by San Diego-based writer Jackie Bryant about her experience on a water drop through the deserts of the U.S.-Mexico border. And then we have On the Plain of Snakes, A Mexican Journey by Paul Theroux. Probably best known for his 1981 novel, The Mosquito Coast, Theroux has established himself as one of America's foremost travel writers. His most recent book sees him recounting 2,000-mile journey along the U.S.-Mexico border. In the process, he humanizes the places most Americans consider off-limits or even dangerous, revealing them to be an enlightening travel destinations. And this is 448 pages. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is the title publisher. And then we have Atlas Obscura series with various contributors. Speaking of unlikely travel destinations, that's what online magazine Atlas Obscura has specialized in for over a decade. The company's collected books, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Wonders, and the youth-focused Explorer's Guide for the World's Most Adventurous Kid, are filled with insightful tips and amazing pictures of inconspicuous locales. Workman Publishing is the publisher here. Then we have Modern Classics, The Geography of Bliss by Eric Beiner. The subtitle says it all, One Grump Search for the Happiest Places in the World. The NPR foreign correspondent globetrots from Iceland to Morocco and dozens of places in between looking for solace. His book is published by the Holchek Za Publishers, 345 pages, and they have a subsection called 12. That's the name of the branch that does the classics. Then we have A.A. Gill is Away, and this is written by A.A. Gill. In Britain, the late A.A. Gill is a household name thanks to his snarky columns on TV and food. His travel writing is just as pugnacious in this collection of dispatches from places like War-Torn Sudan and Fashion Week in Milan. 305 pages, Simon and Schuster, the publisher. And our final selection, Down Under, Travels in a Sunburned Country by Bill Bryson. Those who have always wanted to travel to Australia will find no better tour guide than Bill Bryson's 2000 travelogue. It's filled with first-hand accounts of all the major destinations while weaving in fascinating historical information. 352 pages, and this one's done by Broadway Books. So there you go. Lots of fun things there to read if you want to travel and escape. And then we're going to close our journey with another short essay by the editor of our state magazine, Elizabeth Hudson. This one's titled Advice for a First-Time Camper, and again found in her book, in a collection of her essays. It's called Silver Linings, published by our state. The first and only s'more I've ever eaten was indoors, not by a campfire, not beneath a moonlit sky, but at a restaurant in Atlantic Beach called Amos Mosquitoes. I had the oyster, scallop, and shrimp platter with fries, delicious, in parentheses, and at the end of the meal, the server brought over a tabletop hibachi grill, miniature Hershey bars, a stack of graham crackers, 6 large marshmallows, and a handful of wooden skewers. Everybody at my table squealed, catapulted back to childhood camping trips at Hanging Rock, at Pilot Mountain, at Jones Lake. But I sat silent, no camping memories of my own to contribute. I didn't even know how to assemble my s'more. I grew up with the Yuwari National Forest in my backyard and my Holly Bluff family campground less than 6 miles away. My dad had a shelf of Foxfire books, and I read them all, learning the skills that seemed useful for surviving in the wilderness, like which wood to use to start a fire, parentheses pine, and how to make my own sassafras tea. My high school boyfriend was an outdoors guy, a trout fisherman, and deer hunter who spent weekends, when he wasn't with me, in a tent in the woods near Lake Reese. Now at 47 years old, I'm craving an experience I never had. My mother tells me that I'm wrong, that I don't really want to go camping, that I don't like mosquitoes or being too hot or being too cold or having dirt on my feet, and despite how often I played by the creek in the woods, I always ran back home before dark, in time for a hot bath and a home-cooked supper, and that she and my dad sent me to camp once when I was a child. Don't you remember that? Her words. The YMCA's Camp Cedarwood, and I went stiff as a board when the camp guide lifted me up onto a towering horse, and after I nicked my ear pulling back on the bow in the archery session, I called my parents to please let me come home and never send me back to this torturous place. But that was a long time ago. The outdoors haven't changed, but I hope that I have. A few years ago, I started day hiking. I have a small backpack and the right shoes and wool socks, and sometimes when I'm deep in the woods, I think about what it would be like just to stay there, to find a spot with soft leaves and lay down a sleeping pad and blanket and turn my head toward the stars. I'm preparing. I've researched which camp stove to buy and save recipes for hamburger dinners in foil. I've listened to Ask a Ranger podcast on the NC State Parks website. I've even picked out my campsite at Lake James State Park. I like Site 6 at the Catawba River area, which has a beautiful view of Lake James and is 90 feet from drinking water. I want to know how dark it'll get when the sun goes down. I want to see sparkles on the lake in the morning. I think about this when I sit on the patio in my hometown in Greensboro, where the stars are obscured by street lamps, where I can barely make out the bleat of a bullfrog over the rush of passing traffic. There's a lot that I love about living in a city, but lately I'm feeling a draw in a different direction to finally see for myself what's out there. So there you go, some advice for a first-time camper. At least you can get your imagination going on what it might be like if you were to just go outside and put a blanket down in the yard and stare up at the stars at night, huh? Well, my friend, that's it. We've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Travel. We hope you'll be listening next time, that you've enjoyed today's journey. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, the content of the program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments or questions may be directed to 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.